I know that there is one presence. There's one life. And I call that life God. And I believe that God is good, whole and complete, that it is love, it is peace, it is giving. And because there's only this one, that everything and everyone is made of it, made of that love, that giving, that peace, that wholeness. And because this is what all is made of, I know that that is the truth of me. And so right here, right now, I speak this word for myself and for all who are here. I speak this word for the world, for all things, because I'm speaking back to God as it is showing up in and through all, as this great love and this life of givingness, of wholeness, and peace. And I know that because this is the truth of what it all is, that this season is a reminder. As that stillness in the air, as the gentle snows are falling, that God is speaking peace, love, and givingness to all. And so I know that this truth is encompassing all in the world, holding all in that peace, in that love, giving everything that is needed, in that unifying wholeness. And I give great thanks for this, knowing that I may let go and let God be what God is. Right here, right now, and forevermore. And so I release this word into that law, that action that makes it so right now. And with that joy, I simply say, and so it is.
This month we're looking at the idea of the return of light. We celebrate that the whole month. There's so many festivals and honorings of that return of light this month. And in the darkest of months, we celebrate the light. And I think that says something to our human psyche, to our human soul, that we recognize that even in the darkness, there is always that light. And so we put our attention on that. And so today we're going to look at the second of our stories about light. Last week we looked at the story of Hanukkah, which began last Monday evening and is still going this week. Today we're going to, however, look at the story of the Buddha. Yesterday was Bodhi Day, and Bodhi Day is a Buddhist holiday that celebrates the enlightenment of the Buddha. And so we're going to take a look at the light of the Buddha. And this story, like all three of the stories we're looking at this month, is factually dubious. In other words, it may not have exactly happened as it was written down. The story of Hanukkah is factually dubious. We're going to look later on at the story of the birth of a guy named Jesus, and that's of dubious origin. And today we look at the Buddha. And the Buddha is actually probably a little more factually accurate, but still there are so many legends and so much stuff, and it was so long ago. So what we know about the Buddha, that he was born somewhere between, this is a close range, 563 and 480, that's 80 years difference, before the Christian era, before Jesus, in India. And there's these legends about him, that he was born without intercourse, conceived without intercourse, and born without pain to his mother. Kind of an immaculate conception plus, right? He had no need for food, no need for sleep, no need for medicine or bathing. Whoa. But he did all those just to kind of blend in. That's what they said. He was omniscient, meaning he knew everything, and he could suppress karma. He could, you know, make the law not work. And it even said that from an infinite on, flowers grew in his footsteps. As soon as he would take his steps, flowers would just bloom right there. So all these legends, these are what I call the stuff of worship and legends. We have this need to, our tendency to deify and idolize spiritual teachers, right? I want to see about 300 years from now what they say about Ernest Holmes, the God man, Ernest Holmes, who was born with immaculately, yes. And wise men followed a star to Maine and visited him at his birth. I don't know. But what I want to look at in the story that's the soul story, because out of these stories, even though they're not necessarily factually true, there are soul stories. There are things that call to us deeply that we get to look at and experience. And so if we can look at the soul stories, we're going to look at his journey to enlightenment, because his journey to enlightenment is, guess whose journey to enlightenment? Our own, right? And so we can look at the common denominators. So the Buddha started, his father was a very wealthy tribal leader, basically considered a kind of a king or a prince. And he was raised in a completely protected environment. He was raised in a huge compound. How many of you saw the movie Truman's World? Remember that one where he's raised in the bubble and everybody watches him on TV in this totally protected environment? So that's kind of how the Buddha was raised without the TV. Okay. His father wanted him raised without religious teachings of any kind and without exposure to suffering of any kind. How many of us like to protect our children from exposure to suffering of any kind? Right? Can you do it? No. At 16, he was married to one of his cousins through an arranged marriage. He had a son. And by 29, he was sick of this. He was done with this. And he said, I want to go outside the walls of the compound. I don't care how big it is, how much cool stuff is in it. I want to go outside the walls of the compound. So he asked his charioteer, actually he commanded his charioteer, because his charioteer was never supposed to take him outside the walls. And he says, you're going to do it. And he took him outside the walls of the compound so that he could meet his subjects. You know, he was supposed to be the prince, the next ruler. And he encountered an old man, and he had never seen an old man before. He had never seen aging before. He'd not been exposed to that. On further trips, he insisted on going on. He encountered a sick man, a diseased man, and he encountered a corpse. And he also encountered an ascetic, which is a monk that basically has renounced all worldly things. And he had all these different encounters. And so take a look at this. Is symbolic. There are three types of suffering, you know, that are prevalent for all of us. There's old age, there's death, and there's sickness that are prevalent for all of us. And he sees a way out. He sees a pathway through this in the monk. And so this whole thing disturbed him so much that he decided that he needed to spend the rest of his life understanding the nature of suffering and, more importantly, how to free ourselves from it. So he left the palace on his beautiful white horse and left that life behind. Basically, stepped off the horse, got rid of his clothes, took on the robes, and started to lead the life of an ascetic monk, begging for alms, living on just a bare minimum of food, and renouncing everything of the world, all the material possessions he had. So he goes from super rich to nothing. Back and forth. not back and forth, just once. He traveled with five other monks who were also doing the same path, and he studied meditation from two different meditation teachers. After 6 years of doing this, of living basically, as they said, on a few grains of rice and a few nuts a day, which is not a lot, I would starve. There's no chocolate. I couldn't do this path. After 6 years of that, he was crossing a stream when he basically fell over, passed out from hunger, and practically drowned. And a young woman pulled him out of the stream and gave him food. And, of course, his buddies, his companions, abandoned him. They said, yeah, you quit. You're undisciplined. You accepted that food. He, on the other hand, had the aha that what was that he started to talk about what he called the middle way, the way of moderation, neither excessive self-indulgence nor excessive self-denial, self-mortification. That there's a path, as he said, having that self-mortification, having so little food, just leaves you so hungry and so stupid that you don't even know what you're doing. You're just basically existing. And that's not the path. But the path of material indulgence also is not the path. And so to find the place in the middle of that. Shortly after this experience, he sat down under what's called a peepal tree, which is a type of fig tree that grows in India. And it's called a sacred peepal or sacred fig. And it's also known as the Bodhi tree. And so he sat down underneath that and he vowed not to leave, not to arise until he knew truth. Until he had pierced this veil, pierced this idea of what is it that suffering is, the nature of suffering, and how to move through it. And so he sat all night under this Bodhi tree, and it said that as the morning star arose, that he had this aha, this insight, this moment of profound awareness in which he could see the nature of suffering and how to release it. It said that during the night, he was tempted by the demon Mara. And Mara symbolizes that which is antagonistic to or against enlightenment, against perceiving the truth. How many of us have Maras in our lives? My hand is up. Both my hands are up. Okay? The thing that keeps us from perceiving the truth. And it said that his daughters, the daughters of Mara, came to him, those beautiful women who stripped in front of him to try and seduce him. And it's interesting, so Buddha has these three temptations. Do you remember who else had three temptations? Uh-huh. Yeah, that guy. And it's interesting because the Buddha's temptations are temptations of desire. Jesus' temptations out in the desert are temptations of power. Turn this stone into bread, throw yourself off the temple, and the angels will rescue you. Take yourself up run the throne, run the country. Different. It's interesting to see the difference of, and both of these are challenges for all of us, right? The desire for stuff and people and things, and the desire for power. These are our temptations. These are our Maras, if you will. The three daughters of Mara, the first one is considered the sense of thirst or craving or longing. It's clinging to things as they are or as we would like them to be. We experience a lot of that, by the way, right now around Christmas time. We want the Christmases we remember from our childhood or the Christmases we wish we had as our childhood. Things as they used to be, things as they never were, but we wish they were. Both of them are illusions. Both of them keep us from being present to the Christmas present, right? Now we think of Scrooge, Christmas past, Christmas future, Christmas present. So the first one is that thirst, that craving, that longing. The second one is the opposite of that. It's an aversion. It's a hate. It's a discontent. It's a pushing away of life. I don't want to be here. Anybody besides me ever have that thought? I don't want to be here? Okay. Which keeps us from being present with what is here. And then the third one is attachment or desire or greed or passion that's attached to a sensory object. It arises from the sense of I'm separate from that, and so I want that. And it can be a person, it can be a place, it can be a thing, it can be, whatever that is, that sensory object, I've got to have that. I've got to have that. And when we believe that we're separate from the universe. We don't recognize that we already have it. There's that wonderful story of the fish who goes looking for water, right? While they're immersed in water. And we're oftentimes like that. We go looking for love when we're immersed in a field of love. We go looking for wealth when they're immersed in a field of wealth. We go looking for when we're already it in form. And so those are the three daughters, the three temptations, if you will, that thirst, that craving, that longing, that aversion or hate or pushing it away, or that neediness. Chocolate. I don't know that one at all, but I've heard. So after sitting all that night, he had this profound breakthrough, and then he sat for 49 more days just in that peace. And that does not mean he didn't get up and go have food and do other stuff. It just meant that he spent 49 days in further meditation, deeper meditation, deepening into the sense, deepening in the awareness, experiencing that peace. One of the stories is the Buddha did not want to teach what he had learned because he didn't feel that anybody would understand it. And fortunately, a spiritual teacher of his said, you have to, because there are some who will. Many will not, you're right, but some will. If you're familiar with Joseph Campbell and the hero's journey myth, there's a point where the hero has achieved the goal, has gotten whatever it is that he's or she is supposed to get, and they have to return to their normal life, to their village, to their wherever they came from, and bring back the gift of understanding that they got from that process. And oftentimes for the hero, it's tempting to stay on the journey. It's so much more fun and so much richer than stepping off and saying, I have to bring the gift that I've received from this journey and bring it back. And so eventually he went and met his five companions that he had been with. They kind of at first were a little reluctant, but they realized that they could see that he was on fire with something. He was lit up, literally. Literally, the word Buddha means awakened one. People ask him, are you an incarnation of this or are you an incarnation of that God? And he says, no, I am just one who is awake. I'm just one who is awake. Michael Beckwith says that we're all asleep. And some of us are deeply in sleep, bumping around through the world, having no clue that we're asleep. Others of us are more lightly asleep, and we begin to be aware that we don't know what we don't know. We start to be aware that we can go bumping into things, but we at least have an awareness of who we are and that there is an awakening possible, and we're starting to move towards that. And I'm suspecting that everybody in this room is a light sleeper. I hear snoring, I'm still going to be upset. But a light sleeper. We are starting to be awake. We are starting to know that there's something more. We are starting to know our responsibility, our existence, our effect on life. So the insights of the Buddha, he started with that nothing exists in isolation. Everything is interconnected. Nothing arises without something else arising also. Everything is interconnected. And all beings are endowed with the nature of awakening. Now, in India at his time, that was a radical statement because they had the caste system. And certain people in caste, certain castes were considered higher than others. And they were deserving of, through many rebirths, et cetera, whatever, of being awakened. It's sort of like when some guys a couple hundred years ago wrote, all men are created equal. You've heard that one, right? Yeah. At the time they wrote it, they didn't really mean all men and all women, did they? No. They were talking about white landed gentry. And if you weren't that, then you weren't part of the equated equal. And yet the phrase, the statement itself, stands and is true. It's truer than what their minds knew of at the time. So the Buddha is busting a concept, a paradigm, a way of thinking of it as only some of us are capable of enlightenment and awakening. He said all beings. Now notice, it's not even all people. All beings are endowed with the nature of awakening. And then he taught what are known as the Four Noble Truths. And the first one is suffering exists. Did you know that? Suffering exists. It's real. It happens. Number two, second noble truth, we make our own suffering with our own thinking and attachments. Religious science is the same thing. So I like to call it good news, bad news of religious science. You know, yeah, we make our own, you know, our own bed and we lie in it with our thinking. Third, very important, there is freedom from suffering. There is a way beyond. See, if we're just stuck in the first two, it'd be pretty depressing, right? But he says, no, there's a way beyond. And the fourth noble truth is that way is what's known as the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path, I have to look at this slide, I haven't seen it yet. Yeah, that's good. The Eightfold Path talks about right this, right that. And right is not a moral judgment. Right isn't as in right and wrong, as in good or bad. It's what we might say today is a life-affirming way. When Jesus said, judge with righteous judgment, this is the kind of judgment he was talking about. This is the kind of righteous that he was talking about. Clear perception. So we start with right view. And right view is the ability to distinguish what you might say is wholesome seeds from unwholesome seeds, wholesome roots from unwholesome roots. The Native Americans talk about which wolf are you going to feed? The one that is life-affirming, the one that is life-negating. So right view is our ability to clearly distinguish what is really going on in our mind. What is it that's really absolutely in alignment with our highest good, and what is it that's not? Then the second one is right thinking. Right thinking is being present. A wonderful question to ask in right thinking is it really true? Byron Katie has made that little phrase famous, but it was the Buddha started it. Is what I'm perceiving really true? Is what I'm thinking, is it really true? The third one is right speech. So after we have a view, we can start to think in alignment. After we have this thinking, we start to speak it. We start to focus our speech on wholesome roots. We start to, as Don Miguel Ruiz says, be impeccable with our word, which is to say life-affirming with our word. Right speech. And then from right speech, we move into right action. This is walking our talk. Do I walk my talk? Is my action in alignment with my view, my thinking, and my speaking? Out of that, do I create a livelihood out of that? Do I make this what I do in the world? So it's not just something that I think about a little bit sometimes here and there. Do I make this how I am in the world, my livelihood? Out of this, do I do right diligence? So I do that. Do I do that livelihood with passion, with clarity, with actually doing it, putting effort into it, or am I just sleepwalking through my job? How many of you know somebody, I know none of you ever have done this, but who sleepwalks through their work? Okay? This is putting in right diligence, right effort. The next one is right mindfulness. Thich Nhat Hanh says that this actually should be number three. That because it's the core of the teaching, right mindfulness, truly, truly, clearly paying attention. Paying attention. Am I being mindful and present with what I am? Yesterday we spent an entire day with a meditation retreat, a deepening with a divine retreat. And what we learned, hopefully, was that meditation isn't just something you sit down and do on a mat or on a cushion for half an hour a day, but it's a way of being in life. Am I paying attention? Am I mindful of everything I'm doing? Am I mindful while I eat? Am I mindful while I walk? Am I mindful while I'm eating chocolate? Am I mindful while I'm watching the Seahawks, Denny? Am I mindful? And then the final one is right concentration. Where do I put my attention? Where do I put my attention? So this is the Eightfold Noble Path. Sounds a little bit like what we teach in Science of Mind, right? Can we see the truth? Can we live the truth? Can we speak it? Can we walk it? Can we talk it? Can we be it? Can we live it? Can we apply it? Can we be aware of it? Can we be perceptive enough on it? And what do we focus on? So this week, I'm going to invite you to do two spiritual practices. Number one, ask, where am I in this story? Now, the truth is, we're all in different parts of the story. Some of us is still sitting back in the protected history of our upbringing. And it may not always feel so wonderful and happy, joy, as the Buddhas did, but it may be that we're still stuck in what my parents did to me when I was a child, or what happened to me when I was a child. That's our protected walls. We're sitting inside of those, still operating our lives from those protected walls. So am I living behind the walls of my historic perceptions? Or, secondly, am I overwhelmed, am I overcome, and am I distraught by all the suffering, both my own and of the world? There are people right now who are so overwhelmed by the world. And they become angry, they become hopeless, and they're overwhelmed. Am I in that phase? This is what the Buddha went through when he walked out of the garden, out of the palace, and started to see things. Am I seeking and learning? I would imagine if you're sitting here, you're doing this. Am I seeking and learning? See, when the Buddha went with his friends, he went to two different meditation teachers. Interestingly enough, both of whom said, take over my teaching. You're way past me, once they taught him. And to both of whom he said, no, this isn't it. But he learned that meditation was his practice. He also learned that being a mendicant, being a renunciant, being an ascetic, was not the path. So we all have paths, you know, stuff that we do spiritually, we practice, we try. Some work and some don't, until we find out what really does work for me. So am I in that process of finding out what works for me and then living from that? And then finally, am I completely committed to awakening? Am I completely committed to awakening? From here, what's that Chief Joseph quote? From here, I will fight no more. I will not make war anymore. From here, I will sit under this Bodhi tree until I perceive and get clear on what is truth. Are we that committed? So that's the first spiritual practice. Where are you in this story? And where are different parts of you? Notice that there are different parts of you in different places in that story, right? And then secondly, ask, what must I become to move to the next step? What must I become to move to the next step? What temptations do I have to release? What are the things that are holding me back? Do I have to release being convinced of the reality of things? See, this world is real, but there's more, right? Breathe. There's more than just our perception of this world. And this world exists as we perceive it. And guess what? Not a single person in here perceives it exactly the same as any other person in here. Am I caught in my attachment to things? Am I angry and hating stuff? What is it that I have to become to move to the next step? And so that's a spiritual practice this week, is to sit with those two questions. Where am I in this story? And what must I do to move on from wherever I am in this story? Would you take that on this week? Is it a spiritual practice? Yes. I want to invite you to do that. And I believe it will start to free you. I want to close with a quote from Thich Nhat Hanh from his book, The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching. And he says, without suffering, you cannot grow. That's the bad news, right? Without suffering, see, the reason for this is, unless we're, I hate to say it, but for most of us, unless we're in some sort of pain, physical, emotional, mental, spiritual pain, we don't move. Have you noticed? Okay. You know, some of you know, remember that a couple weeks ago I threw out my back. You know, it's doing much better today. But for 10 years I've been told and know that I should have been doing exercises to strengthen my back and stretching exercises to stretch out my back. Do you think I did them? Do you think maybe I've had enough of a kick in the butt, literally, because it was my low back, that maybe I should, we'll start doing those? We have to suffer in order to grow. Without suffering, you cannot get the peace and joy you deserve. Please don't run away from your suffering. Embrace it and cherish it. Now, I want to say that does not mean set up a 4-star resort hotel in your suffering. Okay? Notice it. Embrace it. And he says, go to the Buddha within. Go to the Buddha. Sit with him. Show him your pain. He will look at you with loving kindness. Each of us has this Buddha within us, whether you know it or not. We have this place within us, this sacred place that is not harmed by anything physical, that is not suffering. Emerson said that the finite strives and struggles while the infinite lies in smiling repose. So we all have that space within us. This is the Buddha that we sit with. Go to the Buddha, sit with him, show him your pain. He will look at you with loving kindness, compassion, and mindfulness, and show you ways to embrace your suffering and look deeply into it. With understanding and compassion, you will be able to heal the wounds in your heart and the wounds of the world. The Buddha called suffering a holy truth because our suffering has the capacity of showing us the path of liberation. Embrace your suffering and let it reveal to you the way to peace. The Buddha said, the moment you know how your suffering came to be, you are already on the path of release from it. Our invitation is clear perception, to clearly see where our suffering comes from. And once we know how to do that, once we can see that, we are on the path to releasing it. And I invite you to release suffering this week, to embrace it, love it, hold it, and let it go. Let's move into prayer. So I know that there is that one presence, that one infinite mind, by whatever name we give it, whether we call it God, whether we call it Spirit, whether we call it Allah, whether we call it the Buddha mind, whether we call it Vishnu, the Tao, whatever name we give it, it's beyond all the names, that infinite one that is in truth all that there is. And it is pure life, pure love, and pure light in form, expressing as all of life, every aspect of life, which is why all beings have the ability to awaken. And because that presence is infinite, we are in it. We are immersed in it. We are one of it. There is nothing else, nowhere else to be. We are that infinite presence in form, right here, right now. Whether we know it or not, whether we remember it or forget it, we still are that right here, right now. And so we are the life, we are the love, we are the light of Spirit in full expression. And so I speak my word that this week we see with clarity where we are suffering, we look at it, we embrace it, and we hold it with love and compassion and release it and let it go and move past it so we no longer have to create suffering in that way anymore. And we keep working our way through and through and through until we are awake, which each of us has within us already. And so I know that as we say yes to this awakening, yes to this truth that lives within us, it must flow, it must expand, it must blossom forth. We don't have to make it happen. We just have to make it welcome. And so in gratitude for this, in gratitude for knowing that each of us already is this light in form, already is this light, and we are just simply awakening to it. And great gratitude for the light itself, the Spirit itself that is within each of us. I release this word into that process that we call the law, that it knows how to move this forward in our lives, move this into expression and form, and supports us in that process of remembering our truth. And that we can go forward and make a difference. And so it is.
So today in class, we read a book, and it had three questions. One of the questions was, when is the right time to do something? Who's the most important person? And there's one more that I'm trying to think of right now.
What's the right thing to do?
What is the right thing to do? And we made trees, little trees. And the book was about giving, or these trees are about giving, receiving, and expansion.